Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Desmond. This is a show where we try and get better at doing the hard stuff that makes life exciting. I've got a reasonably novel podcast for you today. I am joined on Zoom by Paul Watkins and Gareth Edwards, two previous guests of the podcast. They'll introduce themselves in a little bit and kind of introduce each other as well. We thought it would be really fascinating to get together to just have a bit of a discussion around stepping outside of your comfort zone, and taken from three different perspectives, but from guys that are all kind of going about getting outside of their comfort zone in slightly different ways. So we talk about pulling back the curtain, we talk about transitions in life, we talk about emotional deloading after massive events, we talk about trying to be multifaceted individuals and building frameworks where you can derive value from a lot of different things rather than just the one thing. It's a pretty casual conversation, but it goes pretty deep at times as well. So I really hope you enjoy getting uncomfortable with Gareth, Paul and I today. Gareth Edwards and Paul Watkins, welcome to the Uncomfortable Is Okay podcast.
How are we, boys?
Good. Now, this is a little bit exciting, actually, having a three-person podcast over Zoom. I've only actually ever done these three-person ones in person before, so this will be a nice change, all in different parts of Australasia. So do you guys want to give a quick nutshell of yourselves and what you're about, so that the people that haven't listened to your episodes can get a bit of an understanding of you?
For sure. Go on, Paul. You go first.
Cheers, mate. How do I describe me? Look, I've kind of got two sides, I guess. When Chris and I have talked about this before, I've said if you read my resume, it reads all alpha male and stuff. Like, I've been out to climb huge mountains and I've raced ultras on all continents and all over the world and those kind of things. And then people meet me and I look like a nerdy kid who's just kind of a body double for Harry Potter or something. So in person, I'm a nerdy dad. I'm a pharmacist and I've got two young boys and I live in a regional Australian town. But the flip side of me is I've spent a lot of time in really strange places doing difficult things, hanging off mountainsides and tackling races all over the planet. So it's given me a good juxtaposition to balance that idea of how do you balance being a dad, being a nerd, being an athlete, tackling all these things, and what does it mean? How do you derive your value when your job list and your business card isn't a single line that says, you know, Paul Watkins pharmacist. It actually says Paul Watkins, it lists like 9 or 10 things, and a bunch of them don't have a pay grade attached to them because they're things you don't get paid for, like being a stay-at-home dad. So I'm a real mixed bag, but I derive a lot of value and a lot of fun from being that mixed bag, I guess.
Nice. Mate, just a quick question. Do you have a business card?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah, and what does it say on it?
Look, I'll grab it here. So it says here, Paul Watkins, mountain climber, entrepreneur, ultra runner, storyteller, adventurer, pharmacist, husband, author, father, and nerd. And I'm all of those things. You can take your pick as to what suits at the right time.
Yeah, I need to up my game.
We'll get double-sided business cards.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I've got my frozen little face on the front of it, so it comes, you know, with everything.
Awesome, mate, awesome. And Gareth, what about you, buddy?
Yeah, so I am a entrepreneur. I'm a strength coach by trade. Last year, I took on a challenge of flipping a tie for 24 hours for the JK Foundation here in New Zealand. As you can tell, I'm a kid from the UK. I'm not a New Zealand native, even though the tattoo would say otherwise. I'm not. I'm from a little town outside of Liverpool called Ormskirk. I've been in New Zealand about 25 years, and this is my adopted home. Yeah, I don't sound as rural as you do, Paul. That is a rural Australian accent. And I'm also a Harry Potter fan, a bit of a nerd, a little bit of space nerd as well, which a lot of people don't know about me. I do love my space programs and documentaries and all that kind of stuff. So another side to me, I'm a passionate animal advocate. I adopted two bull breed dogs in the last couple of years. Jax, who's 5, and Kaya, who's just over 2 now. So very passionate about adopting animals.
Awesome, man. And I know that we've got a topic that we want to talk on, but actually I just want to ask you a question about this stuff, because like listening to you both there,
you're very multifaceted dudes. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on that, as you said, Paul, like, if you just take a superficial look, you both, at the stuff that you guys have done, and you both appear like real alpha guys. And do you find that that intimidates people sometimes, and that people won't kind of come up and share their ambitions or share their fears or ask you questions because of it?
I'll share with you the least alpha male story I've ever had. I've never been called an alpha male in my life. Like, that's fantastic. So this is a few years ago now. I was actually at a self-defense course, and the instructor was chatting around going, you know, how people might get surprised and how people make assumptions about whether a certain person's going to fight back or defend themselves. So you kind of went around the room and pointed to one of the young ladies and said, you know, no one expects her to fight back, and no one expects a pregnant lady up the back to fight back. And then he looked at me and said, no one expects you to fight back. Thanks a lot. That's fantastic. That's really helped my ego. So I don't think I'm an alpha male in any way, shape or form. What I did think was interesting, though, when you asked both myself and Gareth, is neither of us gave you like a single title answer. Like, you know, you meet a lot of people and you say, oh, you know, what do you do? Or, you know, where do you fit in? And people would give you their job title because that's how they value themselves. Oh, I'm a physio, or I'm a pharmacist, or I'm a strength coach, or whatever, in one line. Where for us, I think it says a lot about how we structure how we take value in our lives, because we didn't go, oh, I'm just a pharmacist, and therefore you can make all the assumptions about what I'm worth. We're multifaceted. So, you know, that's where we derive value, and that helps kind of give us a bit of a safety net. So when one thing doesn't work or isn't going the way we planned, we've got other things to fall back on and say, hey, look, I still get value from here, and this makes me feel really important, and I have a passion about this. So I think that's really, I think that's a sign of a healthy human being. And I think having that diversity allows you to interact with people in more ways rather than the negative. I don't think it pushes people away. I think it gives you a way to talk to people. So I can talk to pharmacists and doctors really easily, but I've spent plenty of time driving a forklift in a warehouse, and I'm quite comfortable talking to people about that. And I think that allows people to feel safer to talk to you, because you can talk to them about things that are important to them comfortably, rather than going, well, I don't really talk to those people that do this or do that, because I stay in my little bubble. So no, I think it's a reverse. I think it makes you a more reachable and approachable human being.
I think for me, a lot of it has been the physical aspect of my presence. I'm 6'1". You can't tell it sitting down, but I'm 6'1", and I'm at the heavier end of, have been at the heavier end of 95 kilos. So I'm quite a large dude and athletic build, you could say. And I guess that puts a lot of people off, or has put a lot of people off coming towards me, particularly in commercial gym roles. I'm just the big white muscly dude that people, especially women, don't want to approach, because I'm scary. What I do looks scary. How I train looks scary. Even now on social media, you can see the videos of me training, and a lot of people, oh, I can't do that. I'm like, that's the wrong way to look at it. I've been doing this for a very, very long time. You know, weights and training have been my life since an early teen. I grew up in a gym, so I've struggled with that in the past, with people not approaching me or even not wanting me to train them because they see what I do, and then instantly scared off by that. I'm like, well, no, it's not what you're not going to be doing this. You know, it's all about, you know, building it up and, you know, working through stages. But yeah, I have come across that in my career as a trainer. As a businessman, not so much. If anything, I'm the one approaching other people about how to do stuff and teaching me the ins and outs of a particular thing in business that I'm unsure of.
Interesting. And yet, I think there's an interesting duality with that as well, as that some people might find the things that you guys have done or are doing, or the way that you do them, a little bit intimidating as well. But also on the flip side of that, as you mentioned, Paul, like, being a multifaceted individual, and deriving a value from a lot of different things, you're probably in a better position to answer a lot of people's queries than someone else, because you've had all of these different life experiences and you know how to interact with a range of different people. Like, when you brought up the concept about value as well, is that I think if you do just derive your value from one certain aspect of your life, then if that starts to go south, then that really hits you from like a well-being perspective pretty quickly.
our wee boy Connor is he's getting a few new teeth. He was not super happy hanging with Dad this morning. All he wanted was Mum. It's a little bit of a blow to the ego on that. But I've got some other cool stuff that I derive value from today as well, talking to you guys and a few other things that I'm doing. But if I just derive value from being a dad, obviously I know that once he stops teething, he'll like me again. Probably like me this afternoon when I come home too. I hope, fingers crossed. But the more things that we can pull value from, the more robust I think our well-being is, as well as our ability to interact with other people.
Yeah, I think you see that a lot these days. Like, people have all their eggs in that basket of going, you know, I'm a pharmacist and therefore, you know, I get this income and I can buy the things and I've got the degree and whatever and all that kind of stuff. But as soon as the ground shifts underneath your feet, people find themselves very lost because they don't know how to describe themselves anymore, or who am I? What do I do? Like, if you've had that view of, you know, I've got to be the breadwinner and do this and do that and that's my role, and if I'm not in that role, you know, I'm lost at sea. I mean, look, I'm very fortunate in that a lot of my life has been spent in non-traditional roles. Like, I'm a stay-at-home dad for a lot of the week, and that throws people out because they're kind of like, well, how do I value you? Because I don't, you know, if you say you're a doctor, I can put a number on you and I can slot you in. If you say you're a forklift driver, I can slot you in and I know where you fit in the hierarchy. But when you're a stay-at-home dad, when I get the, you're doing that for a while, or like, does your wife have to work, or like, what's the story around that? Like, I almost feel like I have to explain what it is versus going, no, we're just in a position where my wife wanted to work and I wanted to stay home with the kids for a couple of years, so we're doing it. Like, yeah, I think having that safety net of knowing that you're worth more than what your pay packet says you're worth is crucial, and where a lot of people can potentially run into trouble, because when that pay packet shifts, they suddenly lost at sea for a little bit.
Yeah, and I sort of have to second that. I was very much put myself in this bubble, this little box of I'm a personal trainer for a long time. That's how I introduced myself. That's what it was. That's what I did. And then, yeah, it took a shift and started to explain that I was a businessman and just started, you know, a skincare business. And I think also with this generation as well, and the times and technology, we're able to do many things as well. Like, there's more options to us to go, oh, actually, you know, yes, I am a trainer, but I'm going to have a side hustle, to use Instagram terminology, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to, you know, I know many people that do multiple things that aren't a one-trick pony, that, you know, have, they buy and sell cars and they train and they have businesses and they multiple things over multiple different industries. And you're like, well, yeah, we are able to do that now. You know, we can sell on Instagram, we can sell through Shopify, and we can build a website literally overnight with very, very little tools and very little knowledge. We can have a dropship business literally straight away with a few, it's business paint by numbers, whilst holding down a home, like you're saying, Paul, and, you know, being a stay-at-home dad or being a stay-at-home mum and running a small business and writing a book or whatever, going on incredible, you know, adventures like you've been doing. We're all able to do that now because we've got the option and the availability.
Because that leads back to your original point, Chris, of going, until you lift the veil back, it's like, as Gareth says, the opportunities are endless. You can do anything you want, which means you don't have the excuse of, I can't do it. So if you want to try it or have a dip at it, or you're nervous about it, or all those kind of things, you have the opportunity to do pretty much anything you want. Therefore, the excuse of, I can't do it, is kind of irrelevant. Like, well, no, the opportunity is there if you want it. That's on you now as to what you want to do. So I'm kind of linking back to what you said at the start, Chris. Like, until you pull the curtain back and go, I'm going to have a dip at that, you don't know. And the only person stopping you from pulling that back is you. So have a dip.
The quote that I threw up the other day was, until you lift the curtain, until you dare to pull the mask off, until you move beyond your comfort zone, you'll never know what it is you were missing. So that's kind of what Paul was alluding to before, and sort of what we'd talk a bit more about for the rest of the podcast. But sorry, Gareth, interrupted you, buddy.
No. I was just going to sort of continue from Paul's point. Like, what I've found living in New Zealand and being in business for the last couple of years now is New Zealand is very much, and Paul, please let me know if it's the same in Australia, that everyone is just willing to give it a go here. there's that no fear in terms of, I'll just give it a bash. It's very much that, you know, the Kiwi, the iconic number eight wire mentality of she'll be right, mate, and give it a go. And I'd rather do it myself first and try it myself first than pay somebody to do it or buy it from somebody. If I can make it myself, then I'll give it a go at making it myself. If I can fix it myself, I'll fix it myself. I found that more here than my native lands of England, where a lot of my friends that I grew up with at school are in that kind of 9 to 5. I've got to do this. I've got to be an accountant. I've got to be a draftsman. I've got to have the white picket fence and the 2.4 children. And that's it. That's my life. And I work Monday to Friday and I go to the pub Wednesday to Sunday. And that's life. Whereas here in New Zealand, everyone's a little bit more risk-free, I guess. Like there's risk, don't get me wrong, but with doing these things and new challenges and starting businesses and all that kind of stuff, there is risk involved. But I found that New Zealanders as a whole are very open to try new things. And if it doesn't work, okay, take a learning and then they move on to the next thing, or they continue through until, you know, it does work. Whereas back home, everyone is so risk averse. It's quite a strange conversation, especially with friends. I've had many with, oh, you're so lucky being in New Zealand and doing what you're doing. I'm like, no, luck's got nothing to do with it. I've been given stuff. I haven't, you know, I've done all this myself. I've grafted, I've worked. You may see all the pretty posts on social media, but I could be working until 1 a.m, wrapping soap, putting labels on bottles. That's the stuff that you don't see. But over there, everyone's, no, I've got to work 9 to 5 and I've got to do this and I've got to, and that's what you do. You know, we always do what we've always done. Well, I don't understand that.
It's a mindset thing, isn't it? That's what we've got to do. That's how we've always done it. And I think that's so limiting. Whereas people like you who are happy to go, I can go anywhere here and do whatever. So let's go see what I can do and go from there. So I think I think it's cultural, but I think it's also really individual of having that mindset of going, what are we going to do? And then just go and see what you can do versus this is how I've always done it. You know, Dad did it this way and I'll do it that way. And my boys are going to do it this way. And that's what we do. That's really dangerous. Yeah.
We probably, us three are all in a reasonably privileged position now. And we, to a certain extent, I think, do live in our own wee bubbles. So we associate with people who go out and do a whole lot of interesting things and have a whole lot of diverse interests, because that's kind of where we've naturally gravitated towards. But there are still a whole group of people who just, yeah, do things that the way they always have done. And if I think back to me 10 years ago, that was me as well. And that was me as that person that I just, that was the path that I was on and that was what I was doing, because that's, I didn't know any different. And that was the bubble that I lived in at the time. So I think it's, part of it is like, however you want to describe it, if you want to pull the mask off or lift the curtain or pop the bubble in this instance.
Chris, did you have a trigger that kicked you out of that bubble?
I don't think there was one massive trigger. I think it was a real slow burn over time that it was. So basically I was kind of was in the lifestyle of showing up to work, hanging out with mates, playing some sport reasonably socially, and going out and partying. And like nothing particularly wrong with doing that. But I found over time that I just, and especially because I got, I had a couple of injuries. So I ended up with a plate in an ankle and a rod in one of my legs. So the athletic side of things fell away a little bit. Thankfully not from the same injury. But it was kind of a slow burn over time. And I just ended like with that same lifestyle and just kind of going that way. Like I felt myself getting more and more uncomfortable and felt like I was really, really stuck in a rut. And like I describe it to people that I ended up just being pretty unhappy, pretty unhealthy, and just really, really unfulfilled. And it took a while actually to come, to have the self-awareness around that, to say that actually, like I'm 25 here. I've probably got at least another sort of 50 or 60 years to live. I don't want to be living the next 50 or 60 years this way. I don't want to be feeling like this, and I don't want to be doing the same thing over and over again. And I know that, it's the choices that I make that put myself in that situation. So it was kind of thinking, how can I shift this? How can I change some of these things to put myself on a different trajectory, and to try and figure out what it was that I was missing out on from living my the lifestyle that I was at the time. And it was it's been a slow-ish evolution. It's obviously a very slow evolution if you're in it at the time and you're working through it. But I guess in the scheme of my life, it's a reasonably rapid transition. 10 years, modern medicine, I might live to 100. That's 10% of my life to actually kind of change the trajectory reasonably significantly. And I'm sure that a lot of people would do it a lot faster. Some people would do it a lot slower as well. And I think like over time, it's still changing and it's still going to be evolving. And like I'm 36 now. And if I look back at where I am at the moment, when I'm 46, I would hope that I'm in a really different position again. And I'm kind of thinking in a different way, in a new way as well. But it's been that it wasn't a sudden pop of the bubble. It wasn't a sudden kind of fling the curtain back or pull the mask off. It's just been a real slow, awkward pull up of the curtain. Like you've got a sticky blind or something that you've got to jiggle a few times, and sometimes it'll drop back down, and sometimes it'll get stuck in a certain place for a little while. But it's slowly coming up for me, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because people, I think, and I'm sure Gareth would get this too, being in the personal trainer world, and like I was in that world for quite a long time too. I think the time frame ticks people up too. Like they want to go, oh, I'm going to make the change, and therefore by next week I should be doing this, or I should have a podcast program with all of these people within 2 weeks on Instagram, or like Gareth had said as well, people come in and go, well, I should be able to lift this straight away, or by next week, why not doing this or doing that? And I wonder whether a lot of people don't get the time frame issue of going, this might take 10 years. And people are like, dude, 10 years, like, no way. I'm like, well, if you want it, it's going to be worth it. And you look back now and go, well, that was, I mean, I was similar in my transition of getting out of being the white coat pharmacist guy into climbing mountains and all that kind of stuff. It took years. And it looked like gradual to me, but I look back now and you can talk about it and it sounds quite fast, but the reality was it took years and years for me to get from being rubbish at something I wanted to try to being really good at something that I can do regularly now. So I think that time frame issue for people is a thing as well, of recognizing that you are going to have to take, you know, time in the non-social media sense, like years, to get from where you are to where you want to be if you want to make that change.
100%. Yeah, that's I completely agree with that. It's even in terms of, you know, speaking, Chris, in terms of you 10 years ago, like what I know now, how little I knew 10 years ago. And these, you know, you see it on the daily, these new trainers getting into the world, and, you know, the young and excitable and, you know, young little puppies of training, and you're like, oh, you don't know what you don't even know. It's just, yeah, it's one of those slow burns, and just the evolution of yourself and your own learnings and trial and error. And like you said, that the blind is a great analogy of, you know, sometimes it drops down, sometimes, you know, it goes up in one foul swoop, sometimes the cord breaks on you. So yeah, it's been an interesting even 10 years for me. It's, you know, looking back, I'm 40 now, 41 this year, looking back to turning 30, I was pretty much a child still at 30, not really knowing who I am or the direction I wanted to be. And I enjoyed the gym world, but, you know, didn't realize that I was going to still be in it for another 10 years. Different, I do it on my own terms now, which is what I enjoy more of. But again, in that was learning, right? So I've learned in those 10 years that the commercial stuff isn't for me. I don't enjoy being a human babysitter, being an adult babysitter. I prefer to do it with people that I enjoy doing it with, that have goals that are aligned with my own beliefs and my own goals. So yeah, it's a huge learning curve over the last 10 years.
And for you, Gareth, was there, again, like same question that Paul asked me, like, was there a moment that kind of triggered that for you, or?
No, it was just a, I suffered pretty severe sort of burnout. I'm very much a, and again, this is learning for myself, I'm very much a yes man. So when I first started in a commercial gym, I would just take on clients as fast as I possibly could. And it was a case of, you know, my health declined, my nutrition declined, because I was just working from 5:30 in the morning till 8 o'clock at night with maybe, you know, a couple of breaks in between clients of, you know, 15 minutes to grab a cup of coffee and some shitty food. And that went on for 3+ years, and it just wasn't sustainable. So yeah, that again, like you were saying, Chris, it was more just kind of a slow burn of that sort of that realization that that's not how I want to do it. You know, there's got to be another way. So then made the option to train from home, and it was just kind of one of those evolutionary things. Mm. There was not one sort of thing that there was no aha moment, there was no eureka moment. It was just kind of one of those slow progressions.
Yeah. And like, I know that you've talked about this, Paul, on one of our previous podcasts, but for you, like, what was the turning point for you?
Yeah. A similar story. Like, it's that thing of going, I think people are waiting for like a mystical sign, like something to come down, a lightning bolt to say, you've got to change and do this. And for some people that might happen if they get a health scare or something happens in their family or whatever, and that triggers that. But I think for most people, it works both ways. Like for all of us, I think it was a slow, gradual transition of going, like for me, it was similar to Gareth. Like I was just burning myself out at a rapid rate in, you know, stock standard retail world. And I realized that was unsustainable and I had to change that. So I think it really is that gradual approach, but you've got to have that mindset of going, well, okay, I'm really grossly unhappy here. So I need to do something about that and start chipping away and seeing what changes. So I think, yeah, having that awareness of going, I'm not happy. Okay, well, you need to do something about that, because there's a fair chance that other people may not be aware of it or may not be in a position to help you. So I'm not happy where I'm at. And that was my case in work. I was just burned out. Okay, well, I need to do something about that. And sometimes you'll be able to fix it yourself. And sometimes it might be, well, I'm still responsible for me and sorting it out, but I'm going to go get some help to figure it out, to go, hey, I need some help to figure this out. I'm struggling with this or that. And I think I was similar to Gareth in some ways, and the answer was yes, I'll take it on and we'll do it and find a way, you know, because that's what you do. You know, you just take it on board and you just find a way or what have you. I think I've got better at being discretionary about that. I'm not going to be able to do that, or that's not going to fit, or I can't do all of that. And I think I've got better at going, I'm going to need some help with that. Like I'm not sure how to tackle this, or how I'm going to approach that, or I'm really struggling with this. I don't know whether that's an age thing too. Like when you're 25, you don't ask for help a lot. When you're 35 or 45, you're like, I really give a stuff about my ego, man. I really need some help to get this thing done, because, you know, particularly having kids, like your ego gets put to the side in a very fast fashion because you're now lowest in the totem pole. So yeah. I think you're a bit happier to go, man, I don't care what you think. I need some help because this is what I need to do for my kids. So can you help me out with this or what have you? So I think it really is evolutionary for people. And I think people need to be self-aware enough to go, don't wait for the lightning bolt or the big neon sign. Just start listening to yourself every day and go, shit, I'm not the person I want to be. I'm not happy about this, or I'm struggling with that. And then start taking those little steps to start doing it and changing whatever you need to do. And don't expect that to fix it next week.
Yeah. And I think there's like, you're talking about signs there and the, like waiting for those big signs. And I think
like before those big signs happen, often there's a lot of little signs that there's just something there just kind of tapping away at you saying, hey, 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 look at this, watch this, what's happening here. That actually, if you pay attention to those little taps that you get, they don't start to build up to the point where actually you get punched in the face by a big one. And then you need to create a drastic change right there and then.
And some of those big punches in the face can be like serious problems. Like, you know, all of a sudden you have a relationship fall apart or you have a health scare or whatever, those kind of things. It's like, and I say this a lot to people, if you can learn to listen to the whispers, the little taps, you can save yourself all the screaming and the big drama at the end. Like learn to just find that space to listen to going, there's something not right here and I need to do something about it. Or the flip side might be that it's not right. It's just, there's something I want to do and I'm not getting to it, but there's a positive to it. I want to go out and make this change or do this thing, but I'm not getting anywhere closer to it. Okay, well, let's do something about that.
Paul, I'm really interested in discovering, you know, with the 6633, was that something that you'd always looked at doing, or was it kind of, again, that sort of eureka moment of I'm going to throw myself into the biggest challenge? Was it something that you were interested in before, or how did that come about?
Poor life choices would be the correct answer there. So. No, it was a case of going, look, it's kind of one of those things, like I'd had a big mountaineering career, and I'd reached a point in that where I was climbing mountains where people weren't coming home from them. So it was that case of going, well, we've started to push the envelope a bit, and that's okay when you're a single dude, you're happy to kind of push the envelope a bit, but in the interim towards that time, I got married and then I started having kids. It's like, well, you don't have the right to go and risk as much as you used to. So I'd hung those boots up and I'd got into ultra running and doing that and kind of started to do longer distances and different races. And it's still important to me to go and push the envelope and see what I can do and have those adventures. And my wife, A, understands that, and B, is very supportive of that. And we know that's a two-way street. And that race just, like, it literally just came across my social media feed one day and I just saw it and went, that kind of ticks all these boxes. Like, I've done all seven continents, but I've been to Antarctica, but I've never been in the Arctic Circle. So I could tick that box, you know, and it's a really cold race and I'm okay in the cold. Like, I spent time in freezing places. Yeah, that's cool. And what an adventure that would be. It's safe in terms of I'm not hanging off a mountainside in the middle of bloody Pakistan or something and it's going to be dangerous. But it has that sense of adventure and fulfillment for me of testing myself to the absolute limit and seeing what I'm capable of. So I think it ticked all the boxes and it just happened to come across and intersect with me at a time when I went, that looks really, really interesting. Let's give it some thought. And I have two kind of internal processes with these things. So first is don't say anything about it for a month and just see what happens over that month. And if you think about it every day, you really want to do it. So it's going to be worth the time and the effort and the money and the training and all that. If you don't really think about it over that time, it's not that important to you. So don't do it. And the second test is if you did it and it went really well, but you could never tell anyone about it and no one would ever know, do you still want to do it? And if the answer is yes, then that's the right reason to go. If you're like, oh no, I want to do it because I want to Instagram it, maybe it's not worth all that.
Wrong reason.
Yeah. So that's the kind of thing going, did you think about it every day? In that race, I thought about it every day. And I'm like, if no one ever knew, I'm like, no one's ever heard of that thing. Like, no one even knows it exists. So, yeah, no one's ever going to know. But I still really want to do it. Okay, well, you're doing it for all the right reasons then. And it's worth the sacrifice of your time and your family's time and those kind of things to go and do that. So, and that's how I ended up tackling it.
I think that's a really good point in terms of the thinking about it every day. Mm. I, after doing the 24, you know, there's a little bit of an emotional deload, as I said to Chris after doing that. And then it was just this kind of nagging little, you know, it was that little tap in the face.
Yeah.
Constant little just tap, 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 tap. And that's all I thought about. And then it took about a month for me to learn to vocalize it, to learn to, you know, this is what I want to do next and this is what I feel about it and this is what I'm thinking. And it did take a good month of just thinking about it myself and weighing the options and, you know, how I actually felt about doing it again. And then, yeah, took some, actually some courage. Like for you again, Paul, in terms of the courage after, you know, after 2017 to then turn around and go, you know what, I'm going to do it again. How your friends and family took to that, you know, was that met with a little bit of disbelief and a little bit of denial?
No, I'm epically stubborn and they know that. But I think that I've had a track record. I've had a couple of climbs, big mountaineering expeditions where I've turned back and gone, this isn't going to end well. So I've made the choice to, like, on summit days to go, I don't think this ends well. So I'm going to turn around and come back. And I've gone back the following year and summited. And I've done that twice in my life going, I just, you know, you've got to make that call of going, you know, there's no point getting to the summit and not getting home. Like, you don't win. You can always go back and try it again the next year. So I think I'd had a track record of being comfortable to make the right call and then come back and have another dip at it, you know, more knowledgeable and experienced than I was the first time. So I don't think that was a great surprise to anybody. Really, a few people were like, it takes some intestinal fortitude to go back and subject yourself to that again, having been well and truly bounced the first time. But I think, like Chris said, you end up, your network builds around people you kind of resonate with. And a lot of my friends were kind of like, yeah, cool, let's go do that. I think that's really, really cool. One thing you brought up, Gareth, with, you said you had kind of that emotional deload after doing the 24 hours. How was that for you? And then what kind of triggered you to get out of that? Because I had the same thing after the race in 2019, particularly coming home. I had a real huge dip post that race for a couple of months of kind of that thing of being a little lost at sea, going, you know, what do I do now and what's next and how do I juggle that? How did you find that process and what kind of turned for you?
Pretty much exactly that. It was almost, so for 20 weeks, would plan to do this thing and it became all consuming. I mentioned to Chris in the last podcast, like, my business took a little bit of a dip. My focus just, you know, I thought about training my clients. I thought about fundraising and doing all the things that we needed to do to prepare for this massive event that I'd never put on an event of that magnitude before. And it all kind of fell on me. And then focus on the training, getting the time on the tire and all that kind of stuff, all the specificity stuff. And then a hugely emotional event. And then once it had gone quiet, there was a, you know, there was a period of that sort of week where we were on 7 sharp and 7 days and things like that during that kind of post week. And then once that had gone, there was almost this sense of nobody wanting to know now about me or what we've done. Or it was kind of, we, like, as a culture, we move on so quickly. You know, news just moves so fast that it was almost kind of, you know, okay, so you did that, but cool, what's next? And for probably a good month, I really struggled with my own emotions over what I'd achieved. And what really hit me hard, and I said this to Chris and other podcasts that I've been on, was how much it meant to other people that I'd done what I'd done. I hadn't really, that's one thing I hadn't trained for. I hadn't thought about or put any thought into terms of what it meant to the people around me, to my loved ones, to my family, friends, close circle, and then the wider audience, what it meant. And that took a bit of an emotional toll. That was really quite hard to deal with. You know, watching the video back and watching the footage back of people crying in the Millennium Arena, and even, you know, watching it back the other day, just going through my archive, it upset me just in terms of how much it upset the people around me and what it meant to the people around me. So that was probably the hardest thing that we weren't expecting. I'm sure Tom went through the same thing. You know, just that emotional kicker. And then I watched The Iron Cowboy, which I should have done. I just bawled my eyes out in the kitchen afterwards. It really, again, really upset me in terms of bringing back, and that was probably about a month after we'd done the tire flip. Watched the Iron Cowboy, and just all those emotions just flooded back in terms of everything I went through with the fundraising and the sense of doubt. Like, I don't know, yourself, Paul, and Chris, like, in terms of those moments of doubt when you're doing something for the first time or something that you've done before, but maybe it's extended or it's a, you know, whatever it is that's outside of that sort of comfort bubble, those areas of doubt and everything that James went through, I went through that whole 24 hours, and then watching it again a month later, it was just another emotional dump. I was like, oh, this is just, was not prepared for that. Like, there was all the rah-rah and all that was great. Once that dropped off, there was this kind of, this emptiness of, wow, that took up, you know, 20 weeks of my life and now it's gone. There was a sense of loss almost. You know, I've lost this thing that for 20 weeks that kind of made me who I was for those weeks, for that time, and almost put it on the business card that I am, you know, I'm Gareth and I'm doing a 24-hour tie flip. That was kind of what it was for me, and to have that away, gone now, was really, really difficult for me to kind of come to terms with. And then everybody, you know, did a couple of podcasts post event, and everyone's like, oh, so what next, and what are you going to do? And it's kind of like, well, I don't actually know. I'm still trying to get over the, you know, the emotional toll of the last one.
The what next thing is brutal. I get that a lot too, and it's a double-edged sword, because people are all like, I'm going to value you based on what you do next, because you did the thing and now you've got to do the next thing, because obviously you do things, so that's what I've got to see. And because I didn't, and it's interesting talking to people that did the 66-33 with me, I reached out to a few afterwards and said, you know, is anyone else kind of struggling with that big dip afterwards? And they said, yeah, and this is the danger, because you then try and fill the void with another thing, which can be bigger than the last thing. And you end up, well, my case, I think it's very easy. I was really aware of making a poor choice and doing something next, because you're just in such a hurry to fill the void because you need to be doing something. And so forcibly kind of said, right, we're going to take time off and not pick another thing for a good length of time to make sure that you have that time to kind of recover and emotionally put yourself back in a good position to make a good choice again. And after listening to your podcast the other day, I watched The Iron Cowboy as well after I heard you mention it. That thing is ridiculous. That's an amazing docker.
That's it. And that, you're right about filling that void. And, you know, Chris and I spoke about it last year about, you know, professional sportsmen that is who they are, that's what they do, and then to have that taken away from them, either voluntary or involuntary, with injury or whatever, you know, you see that slide, that decline of, you know, alcohol and substance abuse and gambling and, you know, domestic violence, because they're trying to find that, they're trying to fill that void with who they were and who people knew them as, to then, you know, now they're just regular Joes on the street. And you're right, I took that time to reconnect with my business, reconnect with who I was as a businessman and as an entrepreneur, and fall back in love with my business. I said that to a lot of people, that I fell kind of, you know, I fell out of love with my business. It was still there. I did enough to kind of tick it over, to keep it running on the daily, but you know, the passion of why I started it was not there. So I took that time to reconnect with the creative side of my business and what I enjoyed the most about starting it. And I used that time more productively than, you know, trying to think about or the next challenge or, you know, and that kind of stuff.
I think that's a thing. It's like you had an identity to fall back on. Like I'm not just the tie flipping guy. I've got a business and I have personal training and I have these things going on. And I think that's a thing. If you don't have, like you said, when people put all their eggs in the one basket and they're not prepared to see themselves as valuable in different roles, when that basket goes, they're kind of stuffed. And I guess that's why it's so important for me. Like I've really focus over the last kind of 12 months to allow myself to see value in me as a stay-at-home dad, because that gives me strength of going, well, if I do another race or whatever, that's great, but if I don't, it doesn't matter. And I've got, you know, I'm working this job and I work that job and I do this and that, but I'm valuable for different reasons than I was the sports person or the athlete or whatever. And I think that's so crucial. You have that framework to fall back on, and I've used mine as well, where people, they're just linear and see themselves as one thing, and that's the only thing I'm good at. It's so dangerous.
Awesome, guys. It was cool listening to you guys chat around that. Thank you for podcasting for me.
Chris wandered off, had a coffee and come back. I just,
had a quick nap. And one other thing, like kind of coming back to the end of that quote that we were talking about at the start. Oh, where's it gone? The last line is, you'll never know what it is that you were missing. I'm just really interested in hearing from you guys, like, what sort of things you've found over your journey that you might have been missing earlier on in your life, but you didn't actually know that you were missing out on them.
Gareth, take that first.
Yeah, probably a sense of purpose. I didn't really know I was missing that sense of purpose. Becoming a trainer is great, and I have, as you know, Paul, you have that sort of positive impact in people's lives on a daily basis, but you almost take that for granted to a certain extent. And then, you know, starting a business, and then I, you know, when I first started Dark Heart, I was approached by some charity organizations about fundraising, and took a punt on it and did some amazing work for some amazing organizations. And it really kind of sparked that fire in me that I've got a voice, and I've got a purpose. You know, I really want to do this thing, give back as much as I possibly can, in time and financial resources, to do these things. And I think that was the one thing that I didn't know that I was missing, was that sort of sense of purpose about giving back, what I'm able to give back to people. Again, whether it's financial, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day about being a trainer, and, you know, I would do it for free. I'm not advertising the fact that I'm doing it for free. I would.
Let's be very clear on that.
It's, you know, it's something that is, I enjoy it. It's not a 9-to-5 for me. It's something that I do that I know makes an impact on people's lives. And for a lot of people, they don't get that. They don't get that sitting in an office and doing a 9-to-5 and being in a call center or whatever it is they're doing. They're not making a positive impact. And that's what I didn't know I was missing. And then, yeah, like doing what I'm doing right now, the 24 and now the 60, that's my big learning, was knowing that that's the thing that I didn't realize I didn't have. That was sense of purpose.
Good answer. For me, I guess, it's funny, I was talking to my wife about this the other day, and you look back now, and like in the mid-40s, I look back and go, I can see points in my life where, you know, I could have gone left or right, and I went one way, and it's led me to here. Like, you know, traveling when I was very young, you know, almost took a job overseas and may never have come back and would have led an entirely different life. And back in Australia, you know, I took an opportunity with a business and left Melbourne and went out to a rural area. And if I'd never done that, I'd never have met my wife and had a kid and done all that kind of stuff. So I think part of that has led me to believe that you can overthink some things a little bit. It's like, just, you're going to go left or right and things are going to happen anyway. So just pick one and what feels right and make the best choice you can, and then just go with it and don't worry about what would have happened if you'd gone left. And just roll with that. So I think the thing that I've found is if I had a yearbook in year 12 and they listed the things I was most likely to do and least likely to do, I've gone out and ended up doing all the things I would have been listed as least likely to ever do. And I kind of, that for me has been fascinating. I've ended up doing stuff that I never dreamed I'd be able to do. Like, I'm not an athlete in any way, shape, or form. Like, I left high school as a super nerd, and I joke, I went into a white collar job that's so white collar and wear a white coat, like literally, like it's about as white straight as you can get. But I've gone out and done all this different stuff. So I think for me, things I've done has allowed me to realize that there's a really broad scope of what you can do. And I've found, I think to some degree, a little bit of, I'm not sure what the word is, but the diversity that I've done has allowed me to spend time in places that allowed me to come at peace with myself. Like, for me, wilderness is really important. Getting out and being a place where no one is and it's totally silent and you're away from everything and the distractions of the world is a recharge for me, not a drain. And that's allowed me to come back and I think hopefully make me a better human being in doing it. So I think, yeah, for me, it's allowed me to have that diversity in my life and go out and use those things to add value to other parts of my life. Having this straight line and being worried about staying on the path and not taking the wrong turn and that kind of stuff. Just go with it and take a few lefts and rights and see where that goes and use it to add color and stuff to all the other things you do as well.
Yeah. And like, I think I definitely agree with both of what you guys have said there as well, is that like the things that I've found that I didn't really know that I was missing. But also I think another thing for me is the development of self-awareness and actually the development of kind of being able to control how I feel and in my situation as well, and the amount of control that I have on over the decisions that I make with that if something is happening that I don't like, then actually I do have the power to influence it in some way, and whether that is kind of changing the situation or getting out of the situation, or actually whether it's just the control that I have, if I can't change the situation, to perceive it in a different way, which is going to affect how I feel and how I respond as well. And I think that sense of self-awareness and that sense of control is something that has been really interesting for me, and it's still something that's developing. But yeah, I definitely didn't realize that I was missing it, well, that it was even there probably 10 years ago.
Yeah. A point that you made, Paul, I'm really interested in terms of compartmentalizing. So you, all these things, the pharmacist, as you said, the stay-at-home dad, and then you go and do this, the 66-33, and then you're on your own for such a really long time. How did you deal with that kind of time with yourself? That's probably the one thing that would terrify most people. We're in a world of connection, right? Even now, like as Chris alluded to at the start of the podcast, we're, you know, in three different parts of Australasia right now, you know, and we can still connect. How did you find that time in your own head? You know, how did you work with that after being, you know, who you are outside of that race?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that. One is I'm very good on my own. I'm quite comfortable on my own. Having that silence and that space doesn't worry me deeply. So I think that's a mindset thing. I'm just wired that way. And some people really found that difficult on the race, being alone for that long, and you're not allowed to have headphones. You can't sit there and listen to your tunes or your audible books or whatever. It's like there's just you, and it's dead silent unless it's blowing a gale, and you're not going to see another human for quite some time. And I think psychologically that's going to be real battering unless you're okay with that. And I was okay with that. And I think the other thing was, for me, during the race, I was out there to execute a plan. So for me, it was very much, we're on job now, so we have to do this. So I always say, like, I take photos of my wife and my kids with me, and they're tucked into a breast pocket, but I won't get them out during the race, and I won't get them out during the climb. They're with me, but I don't look at them, because that's just going to, you know, be very emotional for me. So I'm like, I'm here to do a job. That race particularly, or a mountain climb, I'm like, we're here to execute the task, and we're going to do that and stay on task. So for me, when I was racing, it was very much, I'm fine on my own, I'm quite comfortable, and I find that really energizing, but we're also here to do a job. So focus on doing the job and turn all the non-useful stuff off upstairs, you know, get all the distractions out and just focus on doing what has to be done.
And I think, you know, from what I've listened to yourself talk, Paul and all these guys and James, people like Ross Edgley, you know, the Goggins of the world, slight difference with Goggins, but even Alex Honnold, you know, these guys are all very intrinsically motivated. And again, it's another sort of learning for myself over the last three to 5 years was just how intrinsically motivated I am. I don't need that rah-rah. I don't need the, you know, good job, or you should do this, or, you know, I don't need the challenges or that motivation from external sources. I think there's something there. Like everybody that I sort of gravitate towards now are intrinsically motivated. They don't, you know, they don't need the coaches. They don't need the self-help books and the all that kind of stuff. It's all very, would you call yourself intrinsically motivated? Have you always been that way? Is it something that is a learned skill from you, Paul? And Chris, like, is it something, you know, as a physio, intrinsically motivated to go out and learn? Is it something, you know, that you guys would label yourselves?
Yeah, I definitely say I'm intrinsically motivated. I think I've always been that way. But I also find that people like that, I'm the same as you kind of start gravitating towards those people. Those people are always seem to be the people most ready to reach out and get help or get assistance or look for resources, because they're self-starters. Doesn't mean they have all the answers, but I think they're quite comfortable in going, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to need a few things. I'm going to need this from here, and I'm going to need help with that, and that person's going to guide me on this and those kind of things. So I think it's a bit of both. You've got to have the internal fire to get it done, but you've got to have that humility to go, I'm going to need some help to get this done, and I'm comfortable to go get it because that's how I operate.
Yeah, I'd agree with that as well. And I think, like, for me, there's definitely a strong element of intrinsic motivation that in terms of, like, doing the stuff that I do. And kind of the way that I think about the intrinsic motivation, it's kind of the love of the process. It's like the love of doing things for the doing its sake. It's kind of the twinkle in the eye that you get. And it, like, the people who are really intrinsically motivated do tend to be the ones, as you said, that just kind of go and get stuff done regardless, because it's a really strong drive. But I think, like, for me as well, there's elements of extrinsic motivation as well, but also elements of social motivation for me and the stuff that I do too. Like, there is that kind of external validation that you get from doing things and kind of being able to have a big impact. Say for example, the podcast, like putting it out there and like the 12 people that listen to it, like there's 12 lives that I can affect in an hour. Whereas I wouldn't be able to do that in different capacities. But there's also the social motivation for me as well. And I think you guys kind of have both spent time as trainers as well, and kind of in a health area, and people that do tend to get into kind of the health side of things actually, for the most part, have a reasonably high social motivation to do that, that they like helping people. So there's a bit of that for me, but there's also kind of the social motivation of being a dad and kind of showing my son how I think he should live, rather than just kind of going and telling him that actually I need to go and do these challenges and I need to kind of make value-based decisions from like a social motivation perspective as well. So I think that all sits within me, that there's those three different parts, that the intrinsic is probably the strongest. And I think the intrinsic is the kind of is the most important for your own well-being, is that if you don't have that, then maybe either you need to ask yourself some different questions and kind of find out a little bit more about yourself, or potentially you need to relook at what it is that you're doing and shift that to something that is more aligned with the, what does motivate you intrinsically, what gives you that twinkle in your eye.
Totally.
Awesome, guys. I'm just mindful of the time, and you guys both probably have things to do today. But one last question for you.
I'd really love both of you to leave us with a challenge for this week as well. Can be the same challenge, could be slightly different ones, or could be completely different ones.
I should have known this question was coming, and I should have prepared better.
Go on, Paul.
Oh, thanks.
Throw you under the bus.
I can think, I don't know, and I'm just making this up as I go, but I think the theme that I picked up a lot from all of us chatting is that being prepared to have that self-awareness in hearing the little taps on the shoulders or understanding how you feel deeply about something or giving yourself the time to listen to that. So this is probably similar to the challenge I've given Chris and the listeners before, in that you need to find a vehicle that allows you to hear those things. And for most of us, there's so much background noise, you're never going to hear it. So my challenge would be to find a way to turn that noise down. And for me, it's as simple as I go out and hit the trails and go for a run and don't listen to anything and just hear what you can hear and let the stuff up in the cranium kind of decompress and sort itself out a little bit and see what falls out. So I think that would be fine practice that allows you to listen deeply to yourself. And I'm not talking about, you know, become a Buddhist monk and wear saffron robes and meditate for 3 hours, but find 5 or 10 minutes a day and spend it in the quietest place you can find and just don't have an outcome set, just see what falls out and filters out and go from there.
Well, mine, I think an extension from my little challenge last podcast, mine is always going out there and doing something nice for somebody. There's no exchange in return. You're not expecting something. So doing something nice and genuine, genuine reasons, but you know, making somebody smile, I think is always a good challenge, you know, to do in a genuine way. I think a lot of niceness, I guess, is disingenuous. We're always looking for something in return. We're looking for a compliment in return. We're looking for a gift in return, you know, doing something or an exchange of trade. Just go out and do something. I, in my business, and I've got a lot of friends, and actually spoke to a good friend of mine about this on the weekend. You know, I'm one of giving nice things to nice people. So in my business, you know, I've got friends that expect things from me because they are friends of mine. I own a business, so they should in turn by default get stuff from me. And then I have friends that don't expect anything from me and would rather pay me for things because I'm in business and they understand business. I'm more likely to give them something and not expect any payment in return because I like giving nice things to nice people. And I say that a lot to a lot of my friends, giving nice things to nice people. And I'll go to business meetings and people I haven't met before, and I'll take a gift from my business to that person. And that's, I think that's something that was ingrained in me as a kid, taking things when you go to people's houses, you take a bottle of wine or you take some food or whatever it is. It's, you know, you don't turn up empty handed. I try not to do that with my meetings. I try and, you know, make sure I turn up with something nice. And then the problem is if the person isn't nice, I've got to kind of take it back or just not give them anything else again. But that's kind of my challenge. I think go out there and do something nice or say something nice to somebody without expecting anything in return. Just be genuine in kindness because it's free.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, they're great challenges actually, guys, and very, very doable. If people are interested in finding out more about you guys, where's the best place for doing that?
For Paul, it's dragging a tire down a track. So just go and find a track and you'll find him dragging a tire.
In the back country somewhere.
Yeah.
You can find me, you'll find me on all the social medias after we've talked about finding, you know, peace and quiet and space and all that stuff. You'll find me on all the social media platforms. Look for me there. I go under the name The Rogue Scholar, R-O-G-U-E, Rogue Scholar. You'll find me, if you find me on Instagram, you'll find a link tree there and you can get to all my stuff, my bits and pieces and see what I'm up to from there. So easy enough to find.
Mine's the same on sort of all the interweb channels. Either Giving a Flip is my new social media channel where chronicling obviously all the training and build up for the 60-hour flip in May, and then Bearded Entrepreneur for all the me stuff, which is just be prepared for photos of my dogs and my bike. So pretty much the two things that I'm passionate about. And then Dark Heart Grooming Co. is where you can find my business.
Awesome, guys. Gareth Edwards and Paul Watkins, thanks so much for getting uncomfortable with me today, guys.
Thanks, boys.
There you have it, team. I hope you enjoyed that one. As I said at the start, fascinating conversation with these two guys who both massive proponents of going out and doing hard things and doing hard challenges, and really worthwhile following along with both of them on their social channels to just kind of get their insights and like a real-time view of some of the challenges that they're going through and some of the thinking that goes alongside that as well, because it's really helpful in terms of helping you get it outside of your comfort zone. And also the challenges that they left us with as well, both really, really doable challenges, but that are also going to generate quite a lot of self-awareness, as we talked about in the podcast. So would love to hear how you go with those two challenges. Feel free to share them out on your social media channels and tag us, tag Gareth, tag Paul, tag Uncomfortable Is Okay as well, and we'll make sure to interact with you there. Some thanks, as always, to Jylan for your awesome editing skills. Thank you to my brother Jeremy Desmond for the amazing theme music. And thank you to you guys for taking the time to get uncomfortable with us this week.